Welcome back to Homegrown. Bob Hill here.
And Janine Wishy.
And today on the show, I thought I'd say this first.
Oh.
After 6 years of you saying today on the
All
show,
right.
By golly,
take it over, babe.
I'm going to say today on the show, we've got Lee Townsend, the University of Kentucky guy.
Entomologist.
That's what I was going to say.
A bug guy.
Bug guy. He's going to talk about the catalpa worms and the catalpa tree and the interesting symbiotic relationship between the two that the fishermen just love.
They do. We've got a ton of catalpas out at the farm, so we've always, well, you know, I'm not like some power fisherman either, but I've always, you know, marveled at the insect activity that exists around them. And, you know, it's just one of those sort of summertime experiences. You associate, you wait for those sorts of things, and you wait for the trees to basically, all their foliage to be
eaten up,
and then they regrow.
They do it again.
Yeah, it's like part of summer,
they're,
for sure.
They're caregiver trees.
They are. So we're going to find out all the details, the gory details.
And the really cool moth that's part of the process.
Yeah, it's nice.
It'll be fun, the Sphinx moth.
The Sphinx moth.
Very quiet. Then a man named Ron McKittrick, who is growing a fabulous cacti garden in Yakima, Washington. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun to say Yakima, Washington. He's got 2/3 of an acre of cacti from all over the United States, apparently, if not the world.
Yeah.
And we can grow them here.
We can.
Just takes the right preparation, pumice and soil and dirt and cacti.
And cacti and river gravel. And yeah, there's things that we can translate from Yakima, Washington to Louisville, Kentucky and the area to make it work for us.
Actually, I've got the bed prepared. I prepared it 2 years ago thinking I wanted to grow cacti. It's about 2 foot of sand and pumice and rock and a little bit of my mulch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really waiting for the right cacti.
Okay, so you haven't planted any yet?
Yeah, but I've made a mistake of getting ones that weren't particularly hardy. I just grabbed cheap ones to kind of kill them first.
Yeah.
Let's practice. And by golly.
Get your feet wet.
I've killed them.
All right. So now you will be able to learn from an expert. His garden really is fabulous. Pretty cool.
I can and will.
That's coming up today on the show. We hope that you'll stay with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Speaking of dry, I have this 90-foot rose arbor I dearly love, and watering it became a problem. So I went back to an old friend I've used in years past, a soaker hose.
Yeah.
Works really well.
And it's a great way to water roses because you don't splash any water on the foliage.
And they're climbing roses, so they don't bloom that much. And I've got about 20 clematis plants in their babies. So I got 200 feet of soaker hose, ran it the length of the arbor, and then you just turn the water pressure real low. That's the key. You don't blast them.
Right.
You just barely let it trickle in there. Went out the next morning, and the ground was evenly soaked for 180 feet.
Wow.
And it was easy.
Yeah.
So I've got I'm all a way of saying, folks, if you've got a long arbor or a bed, you don't have to spend a whole lot of money getting these underground systems.
And they
a
say
good soaker hose works very well.
And those underground systems that spray water on plants, a lot of that water evaporates.
Yeah.
Plus, it's really bad for plants to be sprayed, you know, especially if you have them set on a regular basis, to be sprayed, their foliage sprayed.
Yeah, soaker, they're cool. So we'll bury it in mulch, about under 2 inches of mulch. Turn it on once a week, all night, real low water flow.
Cool.
Perfect.
Excellent.
Other thing I've done is I've got some pots and tubs way away from my water hydrants, so I'm collecting very interesting ornamental watering cans that become part of the landscape, and I set them next to my tub. So then you just go out there once a week and water them, and dump it out of the water. You don't have to take the hose out there.
Right.
Looks fun. Looks like part of the garden. It's very colorful, and again, it's easy to water your plants without dragging a hose 300 feet.
And that's what I did with, you know, the gutters on the barn now, you know, those the big, like, metal tubs, that sort of thing, and I have a big tub that's back in the vegetable garden to do the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mine aren't pretty. I mean, the galvanized one's pretty,
but
then I have just not a pretty one in the garden.
I got some antique ones, some old ones, and they're really kind of fun to have just sitting around just looking at.
Right.
Now they're functional.
That's awesome.
But
it's
the
like it's a Bob Hill rain barrel.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Excellent.
Rain Man.
Yeah.
Rain Man.
Excellent.
The movie. What's up next at the Wish You Stay?
I wanted to tell you about this crazy, you talk about like a happy mistake sort of thing,
right? Oh,
yeah.
It's mandatory.
I grow amaranth, and I grew it last year in the, you know, the mixed bed around the vegetable garden as a plant that attracts beneficial insects, right?
Right.
So, amaranth reseeds itself prolifically. And this year, I had a nice stand of amaranth coming up in the mulched area around the blueberries, you know, just outside of the fenced in vegetable garden. And I thinned it. I maintained some of it because I want some of it, but I didn't want like an acre of it, which could have potentially been the case.
Yeah.
And Bob, and this is anecdotal because I've looked in a lot of my books and I can't find anybody saying, oh yeah, this plant operates in this really great fashion. Anecdotal at this point, but to date, it has acted as both an attractant for beneficial insects, like that assassin bug that we were looking at,
yeah,
that insidious plant bug, rather.
I remember.
The flower attracts beneficials. The foliage is being devoured right now by the striped and spotted cucumber beetle.
Instead of your cucumbers.
Instead of my cucumbers.
Good work.
And it's just like the happy mistake sort of thing that you talk about. My cucumbers are clean as a whistle, Bob, and beautiful. And the striped and spotted cucumber beetle, which honestly, you all, remember when we talked to that bug guy that had that show on KET from somewhere in Kentucky?
Oh, yeah.
He had said the worst insect that he has in his garden and has, you know, the most trouble with is the striped and spotted cucumber beetle, because they eat, but they also spread a disease, you know, that makes your plant just up and die, wilt and die. So I'm just delighted that my amaranth is serving this purpose in a natural sort of way.
The beetles may sue, you know.
I don't know. They seem awfully happy.
It's a litigious society.
But they're happy.
Okay.
So how could they be mad at me?
There's happy and there's money.
Yeah.
The beetles are going to sue you. Mark my words.
How on earth could they be mad at me?
I don't know. I'll find a way.
So anyway, plus after all of this is said and done, guess who loves to eat amaranth seeds?
Your chickens.
Yes.
Wow, full circle.
How about that?
Perfect.
Pretty amazing.
A perfect storm of wishy stuff.
It is. Can you believe it?
All right.
All right, Bob, what's going on around town for the gardening calendar?
So those wild and crazy folks at Thienemann's are at it again. They're having an English trough workshop at 10 a.m. on Thursday, August 7th, and repeated at 10 a.m. on Saturday, August 9th. They're going to make rustic hypertufa planters from cement, peat moss, perlite, and water.
Cool.
All materials supplied, $30 fee. Contact Thienemann's or go to our website at WFPL.org for more information.
Sounds good. And English. Hey, you've done that before, haven't you?
We do it every year.
Yeah.
The ladies that work at Hidden Hill love to make hypertufas.
And you watch.
I supply the cement and the quips.
Ah, there we go.
I'm a quipster.
Good. Yeah. Sounds good. All right, on to catalpa worms. I wonder if my chickens will eat catalpa worms.
You know they do.
I'm sure they would. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, we're going to find a little more detail about this interesting worm and the sphinx moth. Dr. Lee Townsend is joining us. He's an extension entomologist at the University of Kentucky. His field work literally takes him to the fields for research and crop management. He also provides insect identification, pest alert information, and pesticide application training, and more to farmers and gardeners in this state. Lee, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. We always appreciate your time on Homegrown. Let's talk a little bit about the catalpa tree first. A lot of people view it as somewhat of a native weedy tree. What's its range in our area?
There's a couple of species of them, mm-hmm. and I guess the southern one is one that got transplanted over a wide area way back in the 1700s. So Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi is sort of the original range for it, and it got transplanted beyond that because of some of the qualities of the tree and the wood itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was curious about that. Does it have any monetary value in terms of timber today?
Well, I don't know so much today that it does, but certainly back in the time, it was used for fence posts and rails. It was a straight grain kind of wood, so it ran into being furniture parts and had an aroma to it that seemed to be desirable as well. So those are things that made it good for expanding its range, and it also is a fast-growing tree, which was very helpful in getting cover established.
Has it been found in other continents besides North America?
I'm not aware. I wouldn't be surprised at least if it hasn't been moved around to a fair extent.
Mm-hmm. So for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the way that a catalpa looks, it's pretty distinctive, I think, because it has humongous leaves, very showy bloom, and then like little, I think people used to call them cigars that sort of hang from the...
Exactly. Those green pods eventually would be taken off and dried and smoked at one time long ago.
So they were really smoked. Huh.
Exactly.
I thought they were just called cigars because they looked like cigars.
They actually work that way, I think.
Was there any special lore or mystery attached to the catalpa tree, as far as you know?
You know, I'm not aware of anything specific about that, but certainly from the standpoint of anglers, fishermen, it's a pretty amazing tree in terms of providing an excellent bait, and that's the catalpa worm.
Okay, and that is what we one of the things we want to talk about today. And in fact, Lee, I often get questions from fishermen about the catalpa tree and, you know, how to sort of cultivate them so that they can harvest the worms, kind of create a desirable habitat for all involved so that they can get that for fishing. The specific pest to the tree is the catalpa worm. There's two incarnations, one being the sphinx moth, the other being the worm. Which comes first in the season?
In the season, it's going to be the moth.
Okay.
And it overwinters in the pupal stage down in the soil, flies about the time that you get bloom on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
So the blooms provide a nectar source. They're light-colored and very fragrant, and that's the kind of thing that's attractive to night-flying moths. And those moths visit there for nectar and energy and ultimately lay their eggs on the leaves of the tree. And the worms then show up and do a remarkable amount of growing in a fairly short time.
Now, is that a perfect symbiotic relationship? Does the sphinx moth only go to the catalpa tree?
That's right. It's the only species that the moth is associated with. So they have a very close relationship, and I'm not aware of a lot of other insects that feed on that tree. So you wonder if there's a protection that the tree provides, and it is able to releaf after being fed upon a lot, so it can tolerate a lot of feeding by those worms and not be harmed itself.
Now, describe the moth itself. It's a very intriguing-looking creature.
Yeah, they're sort of a flying cigar butt type shape to the body.
I take back intriguing.
And the moths in that particular family are, one of the names for them are hummingbird moths because they have the flight behavior of a hummingbird.
Oh.
They hover and take nectar with a very long sucking mouth part that they use to drink nectar from the flower. So if you're around those blooms, particularly early evening, you might well see that particular moth flying.
Mm-hmm. So do they enjoy other blooms in the garden in the evening as well?
I suspect they would. Anything that's got a real sweet fragrance to it and is producing a lot of that fragrance at night.
Mm-hmm.
But I think probably it's really specifically tied into the activity of the tree itself.
A little digression, Lee, but this is always a fascinating subject with me, the symbiotic relationships. Are there other trees and butterflies and flying things that only go to one particular plant like this?
There are a number of them like that, and probably one of the ones that is most familiar to people is the monarch butterfly and milkweed. The caterpillars feed on milkweed plants or plants in that group.
Uh-huh.
They get a protective chemical from eating on the plant that not only protects them, but also is carried over into the butterfly stage and serves as a protection from them being eaten by birds. And so many times when you've got a brightly colored insect like a monarch, you realize that it's protecting and advertising itself in that very way.
Mm-hmm. So what's the life cycle of the sphinx moth look like in terms of the caterpillar? All those caterpillars are going to grow rapidly, as you said. And then what do? They metamorphosize into the sphinx moth. And then what does the sphinx moth spend it? You know what I mean? It's like from year to year, how does the whole thing sort of progress?
Well, when you get in the southern part of the range of the catalpa worm, there can be as many as four generations of it each year, just
wow,
from the long growing season.
Uh-huh.
Where we are, probably two. And the larval stage occurs twice, feeding on the leaves. The pupal stage is down in the ground so that the worm, when it's mature, leaves the tree and digs down into the soil. The moth emerges, flies, and lays its eggs. And so you get that cycle going then two times during the summer for us.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who are really looking to capitalize on the catalpa worms for fish bait, using the blooming of the tree is a real key way.
Okay.
Probably about a week after bloom, those eggs are laid, and you'll begin watching then for the growth and development of the worms on the trees.
Okay. And then the second cycle will be, what, sometime about now, maybe?
About now. And probably the first cycle is going to be the one that's easier to deal with from the standpoint of fishing, because you start everyone off even. You start off with eggs being laid in the spring. By the second generation later in the summer, the life cycles have spread out enough that it would be harder to collect a very large number of worms at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do these worms look like?
Well, they're yellow and black and white with long stripes along their body, and then a very distinctive black horn-like tail that comes off of the end of the body. And probably what a lot of people are familiar with are the tobacco and tomato hornworms that mm-hmm. you find in the garden on tomato plants, or if you were around where tobacco grew, that was one of the distinctive large worms that feeds on that plant. So they're members of the same family, and their development and biologies are very similar. They just grow up on different plants.
Hmm. So if you're interested in cultivating the worm, all you really need to do is plant a couple catalpa trees. I mean, would it be smart to even go to somebody else's catalpa tree, try to harvest a couple of worms so you can get a little colony going?
It's certainly a possibility. What you have to think about is when the tree is, if your tree is going to be flowering, and I think it takes a while for them to become established before
right.
they start to flower.
Okay.
Because you've got to have that nectar source for the worms themselves.
Okay, so that's the key then.
Exactly.
All right.
Can they be grown commercially, just in a laboratory away from the tree, if you have the right stuff?
I think if you had the right stuff, but the problem is you need leaves of the tree, and you need tremendous amounts of them simply because those worms eat so much. So a lot of people will get the worms and freeze them so they'll have a supply kind of whenever the mood strikes them to go fishing.
And I'm convinced fish can't read, so how do they know they like catalpa worms? What's with that stuff?
Those worms, apparently from their wiggle and their smell and their greenish-colored fluid in their bodies, just are tremendous fish bait.
Who knew, right?
Sounds like a match made in heaven, almost.
Certainly does. Lee, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Lee Townsend is an extension entomologist with the University of Kentucky. He spoke to us from the road. And, of course, for more information on the catalpa worm and the sphinx moth, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, hardy cacti for Kentuckiana. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a few more sharp points for our listeners.
Indeed. And you're going to get one step closer to one of your dream gardens.
Cacti heaven. Yeah. As I said earlier, I've wanted to grow cacti. I'm one of the biggest cactus plant in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
Well, unlike me, to have something
yeah.
like that.
How unusual.
Yeah. And we've got the guy that can tell me exactly how to do it.
All right.
And our listeners, too, if they care.
Yeah.
He's Ron McKittrick. He's a retired hospital pharmacist who has spent 30 years collecting, growing, and propagating cacti from all across the U.S. and the world. In that time, he's created a two-thirds acre cacti paradise outside his home in Yakima, Washington, that last year played host to the Cactus and Succulent Society of America. He's here today to explain how to create a cactus garden in Louisville and southern Indiana. Ron, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start off, as usual, talking about how and why you began collecting cacti about 30 years ago.
Well, Bobby, it was really kind of a fluky thing. It was not something I planned to do, but as this often happens this way, I had a house full of the usual typical house plants, and amongst those was, as I remember, a couple of cactus. And my living room got so full of plants that I decided to build a small greenhouse and put them out there. The first winter, the only things that really did very well, even though it was heated, were the cactus.
Ah.
And so that kind of piqued a little interest in me, and I started going down and getting them locally as I could find them. And then I started sending away to the Southwest, to nurseries, and got my greenhouse was full. That was in 78, full by 81, and I couldn't get any more in, so I built a larger greenhouse. Rolled them over into that one, and that one was filled by the end of that next year. So I decided I'm not going to build another greenhouse, so what am I going to do? I started putting some outside, took some shoyas and put them out alongside my house, which was so hot that nothing else would grow there on the south side. Now, for the first three winters, I covered them up with plastic with the PVC rods coming down off the bent down off the side of the house and little greenhouse type thing, and really babied them. And as they got older and a little bit bigger, and I couldn't do that very handily with the wind blowing, as usually was the case in November, and getting poked by the cactus spines, I decided I'm not going to do this anymore.
Uh-oh.
You guys are on your own. You either make it or you don't.
Tough love.
Yep, I had to do it that way. And they did fine. And so that just began the whole sequence that went from there, just adding new varieties.
Well, talk about a year in Yakima, so to speak. I mean, kind of contrast. Here we get like 44 inches of rain, and the temperature is maybe from 15 or 20 up to can be 100, very humid. And you're in the eastern part of Washington, which people don't realize is almost desert-like. But talk about what your cactus face every year.
Well, actually, our typical today is going to be about 95, 96 degrees, which is fairly typical for the summers in Yakima. We go up to over 100 degrees sometimes. But the more concern is the wintertime temperatures, which will drop down to, 10 degrees. Sometimes we'll even get to zero and a little bit below.
Yeah.
But the thing that happens is, like in November, especially December and January, it will get down to 10 degrees, but it won't go above 25 in the daytime.
Oh.
So,
you're
it stays
basically
very cold.
We're frozen for at least 2 months. So that's a challenge for some varieties of cactus.
Sure. So clearly, the ones that you've chosen and the ones that have survived would qualify as hardy cacti.
Yeah, so, I think so. You'd have to say that.
So, Ron, are there measures that you take to protect some of the cactus in the garden?
Yeah, there are. One of the principal methods that I do use is to cover some of my beds, which I have some marginal plants in, with a clear 6-mil plastic. And I have railroad ties as the surrounding periphery of the gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lay the plastic over that, and then I tack it down with 1 by 2 by 8 foot long strips, wood strips. And it's just kind of tense, lays right across the plant.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't touch the plant, though.
Yeah, it does.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yes, it's supported by usually the choyas or maybe an agave or something that gives a little bit of elevation to it.
Mm-hmm.
And It will be out there. The wind will be blowing. It'll be flapping a little bit, but that's okay. It still is a little greenhouse effect.
Right.
Now, if you get a heat wave, say 40 degrees, will it heat the plastic up beneath there to like 100? Is that a problem?
No, not at all.
Okay.
It's not airtight. There are little cracks in it in spaces where the wind can get under there a little bit. And the fact that you got some penetration by the spines of as I mentioned, agave or a yucca, that aerates it a little bit, too.
Mm-hmm.
So the hot air can get out.
So when do you first put your movable greenhouse on? Do you let the ground freeze a little bit, or do you do all that before?
If we get a report, usually it's in November, that there's going to be a cold spell coming on.
I'll go
out there
around
the 1st of November and put it on. Mm-hmm. It takes a couple hours to do it, but then it's on for almost 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I didn't realize talking to you earlier is that I think you said there are native cacti or cactus. I'm never sure how it's like which one to use here, but in 49 of the 50 states, is that true?
That's correct. Yeah, there's at least one native species in all of the contiguous 48 states except one.
Which
is?
Can you guess which one that is?
Can't possibly be Kentucky.
Okay, it's Maine.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
It's Maine, but every other state has at least one species of native cactus.
Huh.
Is it recognizable as such? You have the thorns and say,
Oh, yeah, sure.
Say that's a cactus?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, why do we have the feeling it's only in the Southwest then? What did we go wrong
because
here?
That's where the greater concentration is. As you move down away from, say, Alberta and Manitoba and get down into the United States, you'll pick up a few species in Idaho and Montana and so on as you get down further into the southwest U.S., you're going to pick up a lot more species. You get into Mexico, which is where the greatest concentration of cactus species is in the world, there's a couple thousand different species there.
Mm-hmm. So
and
what
then you have Central America, the Caribbean islands, South America, mm-hmm. almost to the very southern tip of South America. That's, in fact, that's the only place cactus comes from, is from the Americas. There's no place else in the world that cactus.
Huh. Now, what would be a native cactus? I want to say cactus from now on. What would be a native cactus in Indiana and Kentucky? What would we look for here?
It would be an Opuntia type, a flat padded type.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also some Escobaria missouriensis, which is a round globular type, which is typical down through the Missouri Valley.
Where would you find it?
You would find it out in pastures, in fields that haven't been cultivated.
Mm-hmm.
They're fairly common.
Wow. So what makes a cactus and makes them more suitable or less suitable to certain types of weather extremes?
Well, cactus are defined by the presence of areoles, which is a little tufted pad that from which the spines come out, the rudimentary initial leaves that come out on the new seedling comes out of the areoles, flower buds come out of areoles, new stems will pop out of areoles. Only cactus contain those areoles. That's botanically what defines a cactus.
Okay, the areole,
the areole.
Sure. Okay.
And then in the wintertime, the water is sucked out or dries up or goes away as a protective device?
Yeah, it does. It concentrates in the stems, and especially like on an Opuntia or prickly pear type,
mm-hmm.
where they're pretty much standing erect in the summertime because they're turgid, they're full of water. But in the as you get into colder temperatures, that water, that material in the stem begins to concentrate, and it will begin to pucker up, and the pad will then begin to lay down flat like it's wilting and laying flat.
Oh.
It would almost look like it's dead, and to somebody who isn't knowledgeable, oftentimes they mistake it for being dead.
I've done that.
Yeah. It's not. Believe me, in springtime, you don't do anything. In the springtime, as it warms up, it will start to draw moisture up from the ground again, and those things will just pop right up.
So essentially, it's its way of going dormant, like trees drain their juices.
It is, and it gives them more winter hardiness.
Yeah. Okay, so you guys don't get as much rainfall. We get a little more precipitation in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
So the roots also stop functioning in terms of taking up water, right? So that's
right. Well,
a protective
mechanism?
The plant
is not growing during that time. It's gone dormant in the wintertime.
Okay. So, it won't.
So the roots are still obviously there, and they're still capable of drawing up the water, but the plant is not in
okay.
an active growing state, so it's not going to draw up the water.
Okay.
But the thing that you don't want to do is, and this is one of the biggest problems, is if you were to water your plants right, say, beginning of November, which I definitely don't recommend doing, but what can happen is that you can get a rainstorm come through, mm-hmm. get a really heavy rainfall, and then all of a sudden get a sudden freeze, a really hard freeze.
Oh.
Now you got the stems are full of water.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so this freeze comes along, and that's when the damage can happen.
Okay. Interesting.
Well, again, I think you mentioned cacti are hardy to 40 below zero in some places.
Oh, yeah. Some varieties are. Mm-hmm.
That's just amazing.
Yep. They are. And, well, especially, you know, yuccas, of course, are notoriously winter hardy.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Okay. Here we are in Louisville, Kentucky. It's 40 inches of rain. How do I create the perfect site to grow cacti here in Louisville?
Well, there's a number of factors that have to be considered. And one of these is that I do not like to see a cactus bed built where there's a lot of deciduous trees. And that's for more than one reason. Obviously, the shade is a big factor. But the other factor is that they're going to drop those leaves, and they're going to drop them right into your cactus bed.
Good point.
And when you go out there and start cleaning that bed out in the springtime, you're going to wish that you had planted it in asters or something else. Because it's no fun to get those leaves out of there.
Uh-huh.
So have no deciduous trees around if you can possibly do it.
Okay.
Now, the next thing is build your garden is drainage. And this is critical. Now, if you've got a rainfall of 40 inches or so in a year, which, like you said, we have about 6 inches here.
Right.
Then you have to do something to compensate for that. And one thing is to maybe have a crushed rock base in your garden and kind of bermed up. Okay, so that gives you what I call the bones of the garden.
How thick is the base?
I like to see it at least a foot thick, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All rock or some humus in there and some...
No humus at all. No, just rock, just crushed rock.
Okay.
Now, I don't do that here because we don't have that much rainfall. It's not a factor.
Right.
But what you're talking about, that could be a real factor. And then on top of that, you have your soil mix, which should be a minimum of, on the edges, like 4 to 6 inches, but raised up to around 15 inches in the center, bermed up so mm-hmm. that it has a little bit of rise in it.
Oh.
Okay.
And that's your soil.
That's the soil. That's mm-hmm. the part you're going to plant into.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be at least a foot thick in the center of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that pure dirt? You mix rock and pumice in there, too?
Okay, what I use here, and I'm not sure if this would work for you or not, we have a lot of pumice available here, volcanic pumice,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, that's available from Mount St. Helens, thank you. And so... what I use now is a mixture of one-third pumice, one-third large particle sand, and then one-third regular topsoil.
Okay. Now, do you know from your experience with other cactus-growing people if there are people in Indiana and Kentucky that have nice beds in their yards?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they use this about the same principle that I'm talking about. Sometimes they will use gravel as a substitute for the pumice because mm-hmm. I'm not sure how readily available it is back in your area.
For us, it's river gravel.
Okay, and that would work fine.
Uh-huh.
That provides for drainage. The worst thing you can have is to have water collecting around the base of the plant and stay there. You get a heavy rainstorm, you want that water to go right on through if possible.
Yeah. Before we get to the actual best plants for this area, you also use special tools, heavy gloves and so forth, to move these plants around, right?
Sometimes. People ask me what kind of gloves I use, and I usually tell them I don't use gloves. And they look at me like I'm crazy.
You get seven fingers to prove it.
But
I say, you know, that.
You employ some other interesting techniques, though. I see that you use a shop vacuum to clean up debris.
I do, know, and my neighbors think I'm crazy, but that's okay.
Sure, it's a great idea.
But, you know, though he's out there vacuuming his cactus. But it's a great idea because you can suck up spent blooms, leaves, that have blown in,
mm-hmm.
and any of the detritus that ends up in your garden,
mm-hmm.
suck it right up, and it's very satisfying to think you've put one over on those cactus plants. You didn't get me that time.
Have you ever been injured by one of your cactus?
Oh, of course.
Anything requiring stitches?
Not stitches, but pliers to pull them out.
Okay.
That type of thing. You know, I would tell people that, they say, well, don't you get stuck with those things? And I say, well... You play with snakes, you know, what? You're going to get bit. You got to deal with it.
Happens exactly. From time to time.
So, from time to time, it's going to happen.
So, Ron, let's talk about some of the plants that we could use successfully here in Kentuckiana. Some of your favorite plants, perhaps.
I think...
good place to start.
The ones that are most readily available
mm-hmm.
and would probably prosper the best down there would be the choyas. The cilindropuntias,
mm-hmm.
choyas.
How do you spell choya?
C-H-O-L-L-A.
But it's pronounced choya. And those are the cylindrical stem ones that branch.
Okay.
And multiple branching. And they can reach, I got one, the imbricata, that's 8 foot tall and about the same distance apart, wide.
So I can get an 8 foot cactus in Indiana?
Well, in the right conditions, if you put it on
man.
The south side of the house where you get lots of sunlight, lots of warmth,
yep.
and good soil, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason that it wouldn't go to that.
That's what I say, why not?
And in fact, Ron, we have a little cactus bed started on the south side of our house,
mm-hmm.
and there are some choya in there, and we didn't really improve the soil that much down there, mm-hmm. And they've done well over the past... I think 3 years that they've been there, so...
Well, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
They really should do well.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to, when they get that big, or before they get that big, mm-hmm. you better start tying them up to something, because they're not going to be able to support that weight.
Yeah, I'll take note of that for sure.
You mentioned the opuntia. It's O-P-U-N-T-I-A?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And talk about that a little bit.
Well, they're the typical prickly pear types. Beaver tails is another one,
mm-hmm.
and that's the ones that have the short glochids, but you don't usually have the long spines on them. But they're very common in the Southwest. They are, for the most part, very winter hardy, although some of the beaver tails are a bit marginal. And they bloom beautifully, and that's the thing about these plants, because these things really put on a show.
So, Ron, are there specifics surrounding getting cacti to bloom? You know how some plants are triggered by day length, some by temperature, you know, some age, that sort of thing. What are the considerations for cacti?
I think the amount of sun that they get,
okay,
the amount of direct sunlight that they get. They can be shaded by a tree for maybe a third of the daytime, but they need to have at least two-thirds of the day out in open sunlight.
Okay.
And that's what really brings on the blooms. Another thing that brings the blooms on is a cold winter. That's what forces them into flower buds.
Okay.
And in fact, much more so than in the south, or southwest, even further south of that into Mexico, where it's warm most of the time, they don't get the inflorescence that we get here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my opuntia has mostly been yellow. Is that the only color they come in?
Oh, no. No, there's yellow with red centers. There's magentas. There are some almost white-colored ones, and even shades of pink, some that are orange, and even some reds now that are coming out as hybrids that begin to show up now.
Wow. Now, what others would you recommend? The Choya, the Opuntia, what else?
Well, if you can find them, and there are some nurseries that would have them available for you, it's Pediocactus, the river cactus, the ones that grow along the river drainages, like the Colorado River and the Yakima River here, and the Columbia, the Green River in Utah. These are ball-type cactus that offset.
Oh. And,
they're the very first ones to bloom in the springtime.
That's P-E-D-I-O, Pedio?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I see a lot of these cactus or cacti in box stores, little bitty things, and I'm a sucker for them. That's where I got started. Are they generally worth buying, frankly?
To be honest with you, no.
Okay.
And the reason is because most of those are quick growers, and they're growing in nurseries in California, where for that trade down there, it would be fine because they don't have to get through cold winters. But those plants that come from Mexico and from South America, where they do not experience, they don't have the genetics to get through cold winters. So if your idea is to put them in the ground, you're probably not going to have a lot of success with them.
Okay. Now, what besides the Pedia, what else?
Okay, then you get to the kind of serious. This is the hedgehog types. Strawberry cactus is another name, claret cup, purple torch. These are clump formers, and they are incredible plants. See, the Triglochidiatus have the big red flowers on them. The purple torches have magenta flowers, all different shades of flowers, different kinds of stems and spines, and they're incredible plants.
Ron, do all the cactus have spines? Are some of them spineless?
No, not really. Some are actually what we would call spineless, although they might have a very small spine or they might have a very sparse number of spines. But no, but they all have garyoles.
Okay.
And that's what defines a cactus. But a cactus does not have to have spines in order to be a cactus.
Mm-hmm. What function did the spines play for those that do have them?
Protection, for one thing, from marauding animals out in the desert, coming along and taking bites out of them, although the wild pigs, javelinas, will still eat them. They'll eat the opuntias. You don't want
looking for moisture, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And for nutrition, they'll eat them. But other functions, shade in some areas, like in the Atacama Desert, where it's really really hot and sunny all the time. Just the shade of the spines helps to protect the plants from sunburns.
Now, do you have any pest or disease problems with these things?
The biggest pests that I have are ants. And just the typical ants that you have in your garden, they will especially go into or underneath, let's say, a ball-type cactus. And the sclerocactus in particular, they love those. They go right underneath them, and they'll go up inside the cactus, and they will eat out the inside of it. And you don't realize that that's happening until you finally look at that cactus.
It falls over.
It doesn't look as green as it used to. And then you give them a little nudge with your toe, and it goes rolling over. And the roots have been eaten off.
So, Ron, so when you purchase your cactus, I suspect you get them from all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But for us here, is mail order probably our best bet?
Yeah,
okay.
I think it really is. There are several nurseries in the Southwest, and they do mail orders. You get small plants as a rule. There are some that have larger plants, but most of them have small cuttings, and that's really all you need. Just go online, and you'll see the list of look under winter hardy cactus.
Okay. Then let's talk some here at the end about your Cactus and Succulent Society of America. Sounds like a glorious group.
Oh, it is.
You hosted it last year. What can you get from joining this organization?
Oh, well, you get a you get a number of things. You get the opportunity to purchase plants. They have special plants that they have available that have been propagated. Usually they're brought in from foreign countries and brought in and then propagated in nursery. And then they're distributed to members. And you also get a journal six times a year. It tells about the new plants that have been discovered. And just all kinds of stuff that if you're into cactus, you want to know about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Ron, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate you being here and learning more about cactus because I'm going to have the biggest patch in Indiana.
Go for it.
I will.
I want to see a picture of it when you do.
All right.
Maybe Bob can host the Cactus and Succulent Society of America's event next year.
3007.
Yeah. There we go. I'll come to it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ron.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. Ron McKittrick collects and propagates cactus at his home in Yakima, Washington. For more information on how to grow cactus in your yard, or to join the Cactus and Succulent Society of America, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob, the answer man, Hill here.
Yes, and we have three questions to address, Bob.
I'm going
to
answer them.
And, in fact, two of the questions are from Doug Stutes.
Yep.
And it's good timing, really.
Alert listener, Doug Stutes.
Yes. Doug Stutes, he writes, I have a lot of broadleaf weeds in my yard, several large trees that are, you know, shading the area, mm-hmm. of course. Earlier this year, he did put down a broadleaf herbicide. He followed the directions carefully, but he said he killed everything, his grass included. So he may have followed them carefully, he thinks.
Carefully.
But,
yeah.
I mean, it shouldn't have killed the grass if it was followed. But anyway, he now has a bunch of dead spots in his yard.
Death is nature's way of telling you.
So his plan is... Does he put more herbicide down and kill off everything else?
No.
Does he thatch? Does he power seed? Does he fertilize? So, you know, what's your advice this time of the year if he needs to renovate his lawn?
He should lean heavily toward starting to reseed.
Yeah.
You get into August. It doesn't seem possible, but you get into August, September is a really good time to plant grass seed.
Yeah, ironically enough.
Yeah, because it doesn't sound like you should be doing it then, but it's really the best time.
It's the recommended time.
It gets the lawn getting a good start while... the weeds are kind of backing off a little bit.
Yeah.
And I power seeded once, and I was astounded how well it did. Now, mm-hmm. it's more expensive, a little more complicated. But, boy, the grass was up in about 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. It was just amazing how well it did.
So, and you can rent those, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I didn't do it myself. A neighbor had his done, and I said, okay, I'll try it. Mm-hmm. And, man, it was just fabulous how quick it was. But, yeah get ready to seed, folks, because we're not that far away.
Yeah. And, you know, for a healthy lawn, you can fertilize in the fall of the year, but later... But I wouldn't fertilize. And, you know, if he still has a bunch of weeds in his lawn, then he could kill out everything and then power seed. But, mid to late August is definitely the time to do it.
Right.
All right. He's got another question, yes?
Ms. Wishy, here's another question from a Doug Stutes.
Number two.
Yeah, you got it. Interesting question, really. He's got a large apple tree, began producing about 5 years ago. He has not trimmed it. It's now large and straining because it's full of apples. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid the branches will break. I know nothing about apple tree management. Should I trim the branches now? Should I remove some apples to give other nutrients and ease the weight of the branches?
Sounds like a Bob quiz.
Yeah, I know it. How do I go about trimming it and when?
All right. Okay. First thing first.
Yeah.
Thin those apples from the tree, and that will alleviate some of that pressure.
How do you do it?
Daddy always used to put his thumb out, and he'd thin, you know, thumb up. So what, a couple of inches, you know, that way. Thumb up. He would do a thumb length thin, a thumb length thin, a thumb length thin.
He was out there for weeks.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can guesstimate your thumb length after the first branch.
Guess what I used to do?
Shake the tree, probably.
I throw a baseball bat at it. Stand back.
That's not right.
I throw a baseball bat. You get the high spots that way, though.
That's true. And here's
you get those 20-foot limbs.
Here's the next issue.
Sure, the right way.
Okay. Fruit tree management is intensive, typically.
Yes.
So pruning your trees in February is ideal. And this is one of the reasons why apple trees sort of look like they're butchered when they're pruned. Because you want to prune back to what's called a spur, because the spurs are what produce the fruit. You also want to prune them back so that you don't have a humongous tree that breaks when it's loaded with fruit. Mm-hmm. And you prune them back in a certain way so that you can actually harvest the apples in a smart sort of way. As I said, it looks like you're sort of butchering the tree. So I have two suggestions: to either go to the University of Kentucky website, the Department of Horticulture, and they have fabulous information about taking care of your home orchard, and you can print it off. Also, Stella Otto, who we have interviewed before, she has a great book called The Backyard Orchardist. Yep. We follow that when we need to do certain, you know, management things in our orchard as well.
And she told me to throw the baseball bat.
I'm sure she did.
It was chapter 4 in her book.
I'm sure she did.
Louisville Sluggers only.
I'm sure she did. All right, one more question, Bob. This one's from Karen. Hey, Janine and Bob. What do you guys know about tomato blossom drop? Am I the only one in the area that's experiencing this? I contacted a well-known local seed store tomato plant seller to see if they could give me advice. And they said it was a hormone problem, which a fertilizer they could sell would address. But I've also looked online and every piece of information there says it's weather-related problem, high temperatures, high humidity, etc. So she thought she would consult the local experts, i.e. the two of you, to see who could settle the question. Is it a hormone problem or is it a weather-related problem? Any suggestions as what to do?
It's been a tough year for tomatoes. I've had a lot of complaints about tomatoes because the cool spring and then it got hot all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. Basically, part of the problem is it got real hot real quick and that causes tomato blossom drop.
It does. And it's, you know, honestly, Karen, it's a little bit of both. Yeah, it's a hormone problem, but it's a hormone problem sort of, you know, brought on by menopause kind of thing. It's a hormone problem brought on by high heat.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So it's, you know, kind of related, but you don't need to buy any fancy product for it. Once the temperatures sort of regulate, it'll be back to normal. Also, Bob, excess nitrogen. This is where over-fertilizing your plants can jam you up. Yeah. Excess nitrogen in the soil can also cause blossom drop. So Mother Nature's to blame unless you've applied too much nitrogen to your plants.
And you can also throw baseball bats at your tomato plants. But
you can too, but
it could be counterproductive.
That could be counterproductive. Yep. All right. If you have a question, you can get a hold of us.
Put down your baseball bat and visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, we're toward the evening end of the show here, and we've got a Latin word of the week that kind of matches up nicely.
I was inspired by our beautiful little hummingbird moth, our sphinx moth, because she so enjoys drinking the sweet nectar from those evening blooming plants.
There you go.
And in fact, Bob, I found two different words that suggest evening flowering. Okay, yeah. Vespertina. Vespertinus, vespertinum, exactly, evening flowering, and then Hesperus, which is evening. But listen to this. It's not to be confused with Hesperus, which means western, but Hesperus, I-S.
Like the wreck of the Hesperus.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very famous.
So, Asplenium vespertinum.
The western spleen wort.
Which blooms in the evening.
I'm thinking so.
Hemerocallis citrina variety vespertina.
Oh, I didn't even know this existed.
Uh-huh.
A day lily that opens in the evening. Why didn't I know that?
So it's an evening lily.
Do you have any of those?
I don't. No.
I want to get one of those.
Saxifraga bronchialis subspecies vespertina.
Take cough drops. That's the yellow dot saxifraga.
Saxifrag. So this is a subspecies that is a little bit different than everybody else because she blooms in the evening.
Bronchialis.
Hesperus, which is the genus for rocket.
Yep.
Hesperus matronalis, Dame's Rocket.
Dame's Rocket, yeah. Great name.
Botrichium, you think? Botrichium?
Yep.
Botrichium hesperium.
Yeah.
Western moon wart.
So we've got the western spleen wart and the western moon wart in the same show.
How about that?
We're good.
Pretty cool. So if you see Vespertina, Vespertinum, or Hesperus with an I-S, you will know absolutely that plant is an evening blooming plant.
And watch out for the wreck.
Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope you'll join us again next week. And don't forget that you can listen to past shows by visiting our audio archive on the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. You can listen to us over and over and over again.
And we're worth it.
Which you may want to do now that Bob's retired from the Courier-Journal.
All right. Homegrown is produced by the night blooming Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.